This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Welcome to Night Transmissions. We're going to start off tonight with an episode from The Inner Sanctum that debuted on February 20th of 1945. It's a piece called No Coffin for the Dead. It's about a DA and his assistant who are attacked by an assailant with a knife, wounding the former and killing the latter. Later, going through mug shots, he identifies the killer as the son of his assistant's housekeeper, who has recently escaped from an insane asylum.
Lipton Tea and Lipton Soup present Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Good evening, fiends. Friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is Raymond, your host, inviting you through the squeaking door. Don't hesitate. Come right in. Oh, it's a bit dark. Careful, don't brush up against that skeleton. Oh, he's quite harmless, I assure you. He's only the skeleton in our closet come out for a bit of air.
The idea of a skeleton coming out for air. Such nonsense.
Oh, you mean because it's already so well ventilated? Oh, how do you do, Mary Bennett?
Hello, Mr. Raymond. Now, you tell me truthfully, is there a family skeleton in your closet?
Oh, yes, indeed. And what's more, we make no bones about it. And get ready to listen to No Coffin for the Dead. It's an original story by Emil Tepperman. And our star tonight is that famous radio actor, Les Tremaine, who plays the part of Tom Archer. Along the swanky East River Drive, all is quiet, except for the footsteps of two men who hurry toward one of the many tall apartment houses. Let me introduce you quickly to these two men before death strikes out at them. The man on the outside, the tall, blonde man, is District Attorney Tom Archer. The other one, the lean, dark-haired fellow, is Tom Archer's assistant, John Frayne. Tom's really worried about them.
I'll walk you to the door of your house, John. I don't like your being out alone this late at night. Whoever's been sending you those threatening letters isn't John. Look out, John! That fellow in the alley with a knife! Look out! Drop that knife, you!
Why, you... You've killed him. You've killed John Frayne. Don't! Keep back, you! Come with that knife, you don't! No! Don't stab me! Oh, the devil killed John Frayne. Stabbed me. I'll remember his face if I ever see him again. I'll remember.
When I began to regain consciousness after that attack, I was lying on the ground at the mouth of a little alley near John Frayne's home. A fussy little ambulance intern had just finished working over me. There was a small crowd around me, and I glimpsed the face of Detective Inspector Lambert just behind the intern.
There. Feel better now, Mr. Archer?
How is he, Doc?
How about got him fixed up, Inspector Lambert? I think he'll be all right. He's conscious now.
Can I talk to him?
Yeah, but better not move him for a few minutes till the shock wears off.
How are you, Mr. Archer?
Oh, pretty good. I feel like a mummy with all these bandages.
Yeah, both hands. What do they do? Jump you with knives?
Oh, we were passing the alley. John and I... John? What happened to John Frayne? Speak up, Inspector. What happened to John?
Now, take it easy, Mr. Archer.
John's dead.
They got him in the back. Right through the heart.
Oh, merciful heaven. John?
Did you get a look at the killers, Mr. Archer? Could you identify them?
Well, there was only one man. He came out of the alley. He stabbed John, and then he swung at me. I didn't have time to go for my gun, so I caught the blade in my bare hands. He ripped the knife away and stabbed at me I don't know how many times.
Six stab wounds, Mr. Archer. You're darn lucky none of them hit a vital spot. That was a brave thing, grabbing the knife with your bare hands. Probably saved your life.
That's the mistake the killer made, leaving me alive. I've seen his face. I'll catch up with him. If it takes the rest of my life. I was a bit shaky on my feet when Inspector Lambert and the intern helped me up. But I insisted on going over to where the body of John Frayne lay, covered with a white sheet. And then I saw Susan, leaning against the great comforting bulk of old Mrs. Hogan, her housekeeper. She was looking down at the shroud that covered her husband's body.
It was God's will, Mrs. Frayne.
Susan.
Oh, Tom. Tom, I can't believe it. John.
Be brave, Susan. John's dead. Nothing I can say will replace him.
Have you any idea who the murderer is?
Well, I saw his face for a moment, that's all. But I'll recognize it again, I'm sure.
Mr. Archer, here's something we found in the alley.
What is it, Inspector?
Looks like the charm off a watch fob. It's broken off.
A charm? Well.
What?
You recognize it, Mrs. Frayne?
Oh, no. No, it can't be. It can't be.
No, no, of course not, Susan. There are hundreds of watch charms like this one.
What is it, Mrs. Frayne?
That watch charm is my younger brother, Peter, wears one just like it.
Oh?
Oh, nonsense, Lambert. You can buy those in any jewelry store. Besides, I saw the killer's face. It wasn't Pete. Mrs. Hogan.
Yes, Mr. Archer.
Please take Mrs. Frayne upstairs now.
That I'll do. Come along, darling.
I'll see you later, Susan.
Oh, please stay here, Tom. You're hurt. All those wounds.
I'll be okay. Right now, I've got to go downtown with Inspector Lambert and look at pictures while that murderer's face is fresh in my mind. Headquarters, I looked through hundreds of pictures in the Rogues Gallery. It was just 2 hours before I came upon the photograph. Lambert, this is our man.
You're sure?
I'm positive. I'll never forget that face. Turn it over. Let's see the name, quick.
Right. Bart Hogan. Good heavens.
Bart Hogan? That would be the son of old Mrs. Hogan, the Frayne housekeeper. Lambert and I both remembered the case of Bart Hogan. It went back 5 years, before John Frayne had married Susan. Bart Hogan had lived with his mother, both working for Susan's father. One day, Bart Hogan had snatched up a kitchen knife and attacked Susan's father with mad fury. Only John's lucky arrival had saved the old man. John subdued Bart Hogan. The mad youngster had been committed to the state asylum for life. But he had escaped 7 months ago. Nobody had heard from him since then. Until tonight.
Great Scott. So that murderous kid has come back after all these years. To get his revenge.
I'm going back to the Frayne house. I want to talk to Mrs. Hogan.
You think she might know where her son can be found?
Who knows? I'll talk to her anyway.
By the way, Mr. Archer.
Yes?
While you're up there, suppose you just kind of check on whether Brother Pete has lost his watch charm.
Frayne's
occupied a top-floor duplex in the riverfront apartment house. I took the elevator up, and Mrs. Hogan admitted me.
I'll take your hat and coat, Mr. Archer.
Thank you. Mrs. Hogan, where's your son, Bart?
Bart? Well, why'd you ask after Bart?
Have you seen or heard from him since he escaped from the state asylum?
What makes you ask that?
Mrs. Hogan, there's reason to believe that the person who attacked us in the alley is your son, Bart.
Oh, no, no. Never say that, Mr. Archer.
I'm afraid it's true.
No, it couldn't be. I swear to you, it couldn't be Bart.
Why not?
I can't tell you why, but it wasn't Bart, I'm sure.
What makes you so sure? You know where he's been hiding since his escape? You know where he is now?
Oh, heaven help me.
If you know where he is, you must give him up.
But he didn't do it. He didn't.
Believe me, Mrs. Hogan, I understand how you feel. But it'd be far better for Bart to go back to the state asylum than to be hunted for this new crime if he didn't do it.
Mr. Archer, if I prove to you that Bart couldn't have done it, would you let him be? Not make him go back to the asylum?
Well, I don't know what to say. You see, I was downtown just now, and I recognized the picture of the man who attacked us. It turned out to be your son. There's very little chance that I was mistaken.
But if I prove he couldn't have done it?
How can you prove it?
Well, come. I'll show you.
Usually ruddy face was drained of blood as she led me up the stairs to the upper floor of the duplex, and then along the hall to her room.
I always keep the door locked. Go inside, please.
All right. I don't see anything in this room, Mrs. Hogan.
Well, over here, please, the closet. Oh.
Is that you, Ma? Is that you?
It's all right, Bart, darling. I brought a good friend.
Good heavens. You've been hiding him here in this closet?
For 7 months now. When he escaped from the asylum, he came here. I cleared out the closet. Just holds the cot. He lies in there night and day.
Where's he, Ma? Why'd you bring him? What's he want?
Don't be afraid, Bart. Mr. Archer won't hurt you. He wants to ask you some questions.
Bart, have you been out of this room tonight?
Out? Me? Not a chance.
He tells the truth, Mr. Archer. Here, I'll pull the blanket back and show you the proof. There. Look at his legs. He was shot in both legs when he escaped from the asylum. I couldn't get medical attention for him, and the wounds never healed properly.
I see.
You must believe me now, Mr. Archer. Bart couldn't be one who attacked you. Because, well, he'll never be able to walk as long as he lives.
Well, now, if Bart Hogan didn't do it, and mind you, I said if, then who did kill poor John Frayne? Well, whoever killed him must have been a rather cheerful person because he took life so cheerfully.
Cheerful, indeed. Mr. Raymond, you've always had such gruesome thoughts on your mind, you wouldn't recognize something cheerful if you met right up with it.
Oh, now, Mary, aren't you being a bit unfair?
No, I'm not. You just don't know what folks like. But you listen to me, because I'm going to make a suggestion that'll please everyone.
All right.
Folks, if you want to give the boys overseas a real taste of home, why not send them a package or two of Lipton's noodle soup? It's so easy to do. You don't even need a request slip. You know, a bowl of hot soup makes a mighty good snack for the boys. And when they receive Lipton's noodle soup mix, they're getting that old-fashioned kind of chickeny-tasting noodle soup. So send a package or two of Lipton's to your favorite serviceman.
That's a terrific suggestion. And here's another thing that pleases me. There seems to be plenty of murder ahead in tonight's story. You remember that pretty little girl, Susan? Well, looks like she's next on the murderer's list. How about that, Tom? Come on, tell us more, and don't spare the gore.
When I entered the living room on the lower floor, a few minutes later, Susan and Peter were there with Arnold Matson, the lawyer.
I tell you, this is a serious problem, Susan, and we've got to find an answer to it.
There is no answer, Mr. Matson. Oh, Tom, thank heaven you've come at last.
Hello, Susan. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
You know Mr. Matson, of course.
Of course. I understand, Mr. Archer, that you narrowly escaped the same fate as poor John.
Well, I was lucky.
Those bandages must be a nuisance.
I can stand them. Bandages are better than a shroud. By the way, Peter, that looks like a new watch charm you're wearing.
What, this? Oh, I lost the other one someplace, so I bought a new one. What of it?
Oh, nothing. Mr. Matson, when I came in, you were saying something about a serious problem.
Exactly. As you know, Susan's father left an estate of $1,250,000 in a trust fund to be paid to Susan on her 23rd birthday.
Yes, I know. And she'll be 23 next month.
But there's a proviso in the will, Mr. Archer. In order to receive the inheritance, Susan must be married and living with her husband on that date.
Please, Mr. Matson, I don't want to talk about the money.
Yes, but don't you see? You'll lose it all. The will distinctly says that you must be living with your husband. If not, then the money goes to 8 charities, except for $50,000 to Peter.
I don't care. I don't care what happens to the money. Without John, it doesn't matter.
Well, Peter, it'll be a break for you.
What do you mean by that, Master?
Well, there's no need to become enraged, Peter. I only pointed out...
Why, you filthy rat, I'll show you what I'm going to do.
Take it easy, Tom. All right, take your hands off me.
Why are you all looking at me like that? Look as if you thought I killed John. Well, say it. Why don't you say what you think?
Better cool off a little, Pete. This is no time for a scene.
Yeah? For that matter, Tom Archer, what about you? You'd like to marry Susan yourself, wouldn't you?
Why, you rotten little...
You better cool off a little, Tom. This is no time for a scene.
I'm sorry. Yes, Peter, you're right. I would like to marry Susan. You know that, don't you?
Yes, Tom, I know.
You two look at each other like a couple of puppies in love.
I'm going to get a drink. The nuts to the 50,000.
All right, George, I've got it.
Got what, Mr. Matson?
The solution to our problem.
What are you talking about?
That's it, don't you see, Susan? You can marry Tom Archer here, and then you'll be able to legally claim the estate on your birthday.
Well, that's a pretty callous thing to suggest, Matson.
Callous? I'm a lawyer. It's my duty to protect my client.
I couldn't do it.
Of course not. Look here, Susan. Is there anyone else in the world who would benefit by John's death?
I don't know. I can't think.
Oh, what's the difference? Are you still looking for clues, Archer? You know who the murderer is, young Bart Hogan. Why look further?
Bart Hogan?
Matson, how did you know about Bart Hogan?
What do you mean?
Well, I just come from Inspector Lambert's office. There was nobody present when we found Hogan's picture. How did you know about it?
Well, it's really quite simple. I phoned headquarters a little while ago, and Inspector Lambert told me.
Archer, Matson!
What's that? Peter!
Archer, come quick, in the kitchen.
Come along, Matson, quick.
Yes.
You stay here, Susan. All right, Pete, take it easy, we're coming.
Down the hall, in the kitchen.
Get hold of yourself.
You open the door, I can't.
Go ahead, Archer, open it. Good heavens.
It's Mrs. Hogan. She lay on the kitchen floor on her back, with blood all over her clothes. The blood came from a gaping knife wound in her throat. And the knife lay on the floor alongside her.
I found her that way.
Her body's warm. She was killed within the last 10 or 15 minutes.
Then the killer's running loose somewhere in the house.
Susan, she's alone.
Good heavens, there on the floor.
Susan, darling.
Is she dead?
No, she's only fainted. The shock.
Oh.
It's all right, Susan.
What happened? Was it Mrs. Hogan?
Yes.
Who?
We don't know. But the killer's in the house.
That madman is liable to kill us all, one at a time. I have a revolver. Let's search the house.
Right. Matson, you go in the kitchen and stand guard over that knife. There may be fingerprints on it.
Very well.
Peter, you stay here with Susan. Here's my gun. Don't be afraid to use it.
Now, wait. Wait just a minute.
What is it, Matson?
Has it occurred to you the killer may be one of us?
One of us? What are you looking at me for?
You were out of this room for quite a while.
Why, you are a killer!
Look out, the gun! What the fuck?
That's better. I'll take the gun.
He was going to shoot me.
Sorry. I lost my head.
Susan, I'm sorry you have to go through all this. Everybody's on edge. There's a killer loose in the house, and we've got to find him.
Yes, Tom. I know you'll do whatever's right.
I'll try. You two, you can both stay here with Susan. I'll search the house myself. Matson, call the police.
Yes, but how can you hold the gun with your hands all bandaged? You can't pull the trigger.
I'll use it as a club. All right, now. Don't move out of this room till I return.
Be careful, Tom. You mustn't let anything happen to you, too.
I went slowly up the stairs to the upper floor, gripping the gun by the barrel in my bandaged hand. At the end of the hall, I stopped before the door of Mrs. Hogan's room. I opened the door with the keys. Inside the room, the closet door was open. Bart Hogan was still lying on his cot. He must have been expecting me. His eyes were wild with terror. He had a long pencil clutched in his right hand, the only weapon he could find to use against me. His left fist was clutched into a tight ball. He watched me, stiff with fear, as I moved slowly toward him, across the room.
Keep away from me!
I had no time to waste on him. I swept aside the fist that clutched the pencil.
Help!
And brought the revolver butt down hard on his forehead. I went over to the window. Then I went back to the bed, pulled the sheet, pulled it away, lifted him. His weak and withered legs dangled uselessly. I carried him over to the window, rested him against the sill. He opened his eyes. He was recovering from the blow. I didn't wait. I pushed hard. He went toppling out of the window. I leaned over and saw the body strike against the 10th floor setback, then go hurtling into the air and smash down upon the pavement far below. There wasn't enough of him left to perform an autopsy on. They'd never know his legs had been no good, that he hadn't been able to walk. Everything would be easy sailing from here on. Susan would marry me to save the estate. $1.25 million. Oh, I'd been clever enough. When I called out that fake warning at the mouth of the alley, I myself stabbed John in the back. Then I slashed myself up. They had taken my story at face value, Lambert and the others. I'd guessed that Mrs. Hogan was hiding Bart, but just as a precaution, I'd stolen Peter's watch chain and dropped it at the scene of the crime in case I should need another suspect. But when I found Bart couldn't walk, it became necessary to kill Mrs. Hogan, too. For she was the only one who could tell the police that Bart hadn't been able to walk. All I had to do now was go down and say I'd found Bart, we had fought, and he had fallen from the window. The perfect crime. I took one more last look down into the street where a crowd had gathered around Bart's body. I was able to make out the figure of Inspector Lambert bending over what was left of him. And I saw Lambert force something out of the clenched left fist of the dead body. In a flash, I remembered that feeble little pencil with which Bart had tried to defend himself. I pulled in my head from the window and glanced across to the closet. I saw it at once. A small white scratch pad. I rushed across the room and snatched up the pad. And there, on the topmost page, were the indentations of what Bart Hogan had written on the page, and then had torn off. I could read it clearly. I could almost imagine his terrified voicing of the frightened appeal as he wrote it.
Archer was here. He means to kill me. He wants them to think I killed John Frayne. But I can't walk. I've got 2 bullets in my legs. For God's sake, save me.
Bart had written that note, meaning to throw it out the window. But I had come back too soon for him. And I had thrown it out of the window for him. I went back to the window and looked down. I saw Lambert peering up. Then he turned away and hurried toward the entrance of the building. He's coming for me. There's only one thing for me to do now. I've locked the door. It'll take time to break it down. In the meantime, I've taken the bandage off my right hand. I'm writing a full account of tonight's work. I gambled for a fortune, and I lost.
He seemed like such a nice young man. Well, his trouble was he tried to commit the perfect crime without first practicing up on minor crimes. He should have started by stealing watermelons and then maybe tried his hand at robbing mail trains.
Mr. Raymond, what are you suggesting? And just when I was getting ready to tell people to send a bowl of soup to the boys overseas.
Wouldn't the soup get cold by the time it arrived?
Oh, of course not. Why, Lipton's noodle soup mix comes in a flat package. You simply send it along to your favorite soldier.
Oh.
And he'll be pleased by your little gift because this noodle soup is just like a, well, just like a taste of home. So enclose a package or two of Lipton's the next time you write to him.
Oh, gosh, I'm sorry you have to go so soon. But drop in again next Tuesday for another little blood fest. You know, some people have to commit murders to get a kick out of life. Others get their satisfaction from listening to Inner Sanctum. But a word of advice. If you've got to commit a murder, please don't get yourself caught. Because if you do, you'll surely get a free ride with the only person never bothered by backseat drivers. I mean that they're hearse driving. Good night. Pleasant dreams.
That was nicely done. Although I do feel that the narrative was a bit of a cheat. I mean, to have the murderer be the point of view character and to follow him all the way through, except for when he does the deed. That wasn't playing fair. I mean, how could you even suspect him when you were writing in his head the entire, or at least you thought you were writing in his head the entire line of the story? Anyway.
Truth is stranger than fiction, and this is the proof. This is Ripley. Believe it or not. There was a shoe worn by the ancient Egyptians with the outline of an enemy on its sole, so that the wearer could stamp on his enemy with each step he took. Believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you the story of a very remarkable man. Billy Marshall, a tinker of Kirkcudbright, Scotland, was truly a most remarkable man. In his earlier years, he enlisted in the Army and the Navy 10 times. Each time he enlisted, he deserted without ever being caught. He outlived 17 wives, and he became the father of 4 children after he was 100 years of age. He finally died in the year 1792 at the age of 120 years, believe it or not.
Oh. Okay, before we do much of anything else, gonna have to take just a little bit of a break here. Well, I promise we won't be gone too long, and then we'll be back with another radio show from the golden age of radio. From the CBC series Nightfall, and it's called The Repossession. Now, this is a tight little horror story about a man possessed by the spirit of his dead brother that was broadcast on October 31st of 1981.
In the dream, you are falling, lost in the listening distance as dark locks in. Nightfall. The play by Arthur Samuels is called The Repossession.
All right, let's have a reading. Pulse 120, blood pressure and respiration normal. Everyone ready, then?
Are we ready?
Ready, Doctor. Nurse?
Yes, Doctor.
All right, draw the sheet back. That's it. Now, you people up there in the observation booth, what you see here is a rather remarkable case of conjoined infants, commonly referred to as Siamese twins. Your textbooks will give you a statistical indication of the rarity of these occurrences.
Well, how could they even survive
Many
like that?
Many cases are remarkable in more ways than one. You should know that in most of such cases, only one twin, that is the autosite or host, is what we would call normal, while the other, the parasite, if you like, is more often than not grossly malformed. But here you see 20-month-old male twins, absolutely identical, both perfectly formed in every respect, except for the obvious. Look.
The obvious is right. It's just...
Will you shut up? I'm trying to take notes.
You can see where they're conjoined at the breastbone. The fusion isn't our problem. This is.
I think I'm going to be sick.
Come on, you're going to be a doctor,
As you
remember?
Can see, these twins share a single heart. Here it is, suspended outside both chest cavities. The heart's only protection is its pericardial sac. Obviously, both babies can't survive like this. So... I'm afraid we're left with a difficult choice.
Jesus.
One can live, but the other must die. There's no other way. All right, let's get started. What God has joined together, we now tear asunder. Sponge. There, that looks clean. Now... What's the problem, nurse? Are you ill?
No, doctor. It's just that...
Well?
They're both so healthy. How can you make a choice?
It has to be either or. You want to be relieved?
No. No, doctor. I'm sorry. I'm ready.
All right, then. Scalpel.
Scalpel.
One can live, but the other must... Die. Die. Die.
Oh.
Bob?
Oh.
Honey, it's all right. Come on, wake up. Oh. It's only a dream. Come on, love. God. It's all right.
Oh, God, that was rough.
The same nightmare?
Yeah, with a slight variation. This time I was dying.
Bob, don't you think you've had enough of this?
What?
Well, you've been promising to see someone about this, remember?
All right, Beth.
No, it's not all right. Do you realize what you've been like these past few weeks? If I say a word to you, you practically bite my head off, and the children are so scared of you.
All right, Beth, will you just ease off? It's bad enough without...
Does that mean we can't talk about it? Subject closed as usual?
No. Just give me a chance to clear my head. I'm going to go take a shower.
Yeah, you really should clear your head, Bob. I mean, how long can this go on? I'm sorry, but I'm getting awfully fed up.
You think I'm not? No, will you just... What in the name of hell? Beth, come here.
What is it?
Just get in here.
What now? Something else to complain about?
What is this? Your sick little way of getting back at me for last night.
Well, what are you talking about?
That.
Oh, my God. I hate you. What does it mean?
Oh, you know damned well what it means. And how subtly you express it in lipstick right across the mirror. I hate you.
Are you suggesting I wrote that?
Who else? It's your lipstick, isn't it?
Are you blind? Look at the message.
I'm looking, damn it. And all I...
Can't you see? It's in your handwriting.
All right, Mr. Stroud, I think I have the picture. You've been having a recurrent nightmare, obviously related to the separation and death of your twin 30 years ago.
Yes. But the nightmare only began a few weeks ago. Why, after all these years?
Oh, any one of a number of things might have triggered it. Anxiety, guilt.
Guilt? Why should I feel guilty? I told you, Dr. Benner, we were babies. I had nothing to do with the choice.
No, of course not. But the unconscious doesn't differentiate between what you were or were not responsible for.
I don't understand.
Well, I'll give you the classic example. Two soldiers, friends or brothers, are caught in enemy crossfire. Now, one lives and the other dies. The one who survives is glad, naturally, and yet he feels guilty. Uh-huh. Misinterprets his feeling to mean he's glad his companion died. Do you see?
I think so, but what about that message on the mirror this morning? Can you explain that?
Well, I can try. How you were somnambulist, Mr. Stroud?
A what?
Do you walk in your sleep?
No. But even if I did, are you saying I got up in my sleep last night, walked into the bathroom, picked up my wife's lipstick, and wrote, I hate you, across the mirror?
I'm saying it's possible, particularly since you tell me the message was in your own handwriting.
But it wasn't exactly.
How do you mean?
I'm left-handed. My handwriting slants to the left, but the writing on the mirror slanted to the right.
That is curious. Tell me, Mr. Stroud, may I call you Robert?
Sure.
What do you make of it?
I don't know. But I can't help thinking that...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
That sounds crazy, but... that Douglas is somehow responsible for all this.
Douglas? Your twin brother.
I told you it was crazy.
No, not crazy. It's just illogical. Your brother, Douglas, is dead, Robert. He died 30 years ago, and the dead do not come back, except in our fearful imaginations and dreams.
So sure of himself, isn't he?
Robert, is something wrong? Are you feeling ill?
No. No, I just... Oh, God, I must be crazy. I'm even beginning to hear things.
Now, I doubt that. You're distraught, and that's all. Yeah, look, here's what I suggest for the moment. I'll give you something to help you sleep at night.
And what about the days? I can't work. I can't even think right now.
Then why not take the day off? You told me you're a tennis buff. Maybe a little exercise is just what you need to work off some of that tension.
Oh, Bob, I don't believe it. You beat me.
And about time, isn't it? You've been clobbering me for years.
Yeah, but I've never seen you play like this. And that last cross-court smash, whew, it was weird.
Weird?
Yeah, you played a double grip, right-handed.
No, you must be mistaken, Ted.
I tell you, you played your best shots right-handed. You've always been left, haven't you? Bob? Bob, what's the matter? You just turned white as a sheet. Are you okay?
Yeah.
You sure?
I said I'm all right. Come on, let's head for the showers, huh?
Yeah, okay. Hey, Bob. I was just thinking. Why don't you and I team up for that doubles tournament next month? I mean, if you just play the way you did today, we'd be unbeatable. Bob?
I'm left-handed, but the writing on the mirror is slanted to the right.
Douglas is dead, Robert. He died 30 years ago, and the dead do not come back.
Can't be.
What? All I said was that if you and I teased
up... just not possible.
How much proof do you need?
Bob, for God's sake, will you watch where you're going? Nearly drove off the road. What the hell's the matter with you?
I don't know. I lost control of my right hand. As though... no, damn you, no!
Get out! You're trying to get us killed? Better pull over and let me drive. Bob, look out!
Oh, Ted, my God, what have I done?
You really did lose control, didn't you, Brother Robert?
Ted? Teddy, all right?
Yeah, no thanks to you. What the hell's the matter? I told you to let me drive.
It wasn't my fault.
I saw you wrenching at the wheel as though you were trying to drive us into the ditch.
No, you don't understand. I was trying not to. But he forced me.
He? Who are you talking about?
It was him. Douglas. It's been Douglas all along.
Hey, Bob, I don't think you know what you're saying. Your head. You must be hurt.
No. Ted, listen. Believe me.
Now take it easy. Let me drive you home, okay?
Yes, Robert. Let's both go home.
Ted, come in.
Only for a moment. I can't stay, Beth. Got to pick up Laurie at school. But I was worried about Bob. Is he okay?
I don't know. I'm afraid, Ted. Something's happening to him, and I don't know how to handle it.
Oh, easy now. Easy. Where are the kids?
I sent them over to my mother's. I didn't want them to see him like this. They'll stay with her overnight.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Where's Bob now?
In the study. He's locked himself in with a bottle. He won't even talk to me.
Let me try.
No, Ted, it's no use. I've already called Dr. Brenner. He was out, but his answering service said he'd check in any minute.
Doctor? What kind of a doctor?
Psychiatrist. Bob went to see him this morning.
Damn. I knew something was wrong. You sure you don't want me to talk to him, Beth? Somebody should.
Don't you think I've tried?
Yeah, I know. I just meant I could call the school and arrange for Laurie to...
No. You go ahead. Dr. Brenner should be here soon. Ted, I'm beginning to wonder if I need a psychiatrist.
What do you mean?
Just before you arrived, I went to the study door. I heard Bob talking.
To himself?
I'm not sure, and yet I could swear I heard two distinct voices. I know it doesn't make any sense, but...
Come now, Robert. Do you really think drinking will make me go away?
Yes. You're dead, damn you.
And you're alive. And you'd like to keep it that way, wouldn't you?
Why have you come back?
I've never left you, Robert. After all, we are twins. Inseparable.
We were separated by surgery. You died.
Yes, I died. Do you think that was fair, Robert? I had every bit as much right to live as you.
We were babies. It wasn't my decision.
How can you blame me?
Oh, I don't blame you, Robert. I hate you.
Why? What have I done?
You've lived. I've watched you grow to be happy, successful. You've had it all. With nothing but that scar on your chest to remind you that I ever existed. That you owe it all to me.
I owe you nothing. I'm glad they chose me to live and you to die, Brother Douglas. And I'm going to make sure you stay dead, damn you.
And how do you plan to manage that?
My will's as strong as yours. I'll fight you. And I'll defeat you.
I don't think so, Robert. I've had plenty of time to observe you all these years. I know your weaknesses. I can destroy you whenever I choose. But there's a happier alternative.
What do you mean?
You had a demonstration of that today. On the tennis court, remember? You're a mediocre player. On your own. Together, well. You saw the result.
I don't want to win that way. With you.
The point is, we won. Didn't we? Think of the possibilities, Robert. Two minds, two wills combined. We could do anything.
I don't want it. I'll shut you out.
You managed that for 30 years. But no more. Now I'm part of you, Robert.
Leave me alone, damn you.
Oh, you're upset. Why don't you pour yourself another drink? Yes, that's it. But let's use your right hand, Robert. I said, your right hand.
No.
There. That's better.
What do you want?
Half, Robert. Half of everything you are, everything you have, everything you do. Share and share alike. Isn't that the way it should be between twin brothers?
You're dead. Stay dead.
No way. I shall live through you, my dear brother. Breathe, move, share your pain, your joy. And when you make love to Beth...
No way. I'll kill myself first. Kill us both.
Why couldn't let you do that, Robert? Besides, from now on, our life together will be much more interesting. We'll have that certain edge.
Sedative. He'll sleep for a couple of hours at least.
And when he wakes up?
I hope he'll respond to treatment.
Treatment for what?
Acute paranoid schizophrenia.
You mean he's insane?
I don't use that word, Mrs. Stroud, and neither should you. Robert is displaying the classic signs of a very disturbed, even psychotic personality.
Are you sure? What about Douglas?
Well, what about Douglas? If you're talking about Robert being possessed by the spirit of his dead twin, forget it. We're going to rid him of that delusion once and for all.
How?
I'd like you to go out for a few hours. Leave me alone with him. I'm going to try hypnosis. It may work.
God, I hope so.
Mrs. Stroud, Beth, I do know what I'm doing. Do you understand?
Yes.
Good. Now, I want you to tell me who you are, your full name.
Robert Stephen Stroud.
Right. Now, once long ago, you had a twin brother. What was his name?
Douglas. Douglas Duane Stroud.
Mm-hmm. What happened to Douglas? He died, didn't he?
No. Yes.
Yes. Douglas died 30 years ago. Douglas does not exist. I want you to say it, Robert. Douglas does not exist.
Douglas does not...
Douglas does not exist. Say it.
But how can he say it, Herr Doctor? Obviously, I do exist.
No, don't do that, Robert. You're disguising your voice and playing a role, and I want you to stop it.
I'm trying.
Can't you see how hard he's trying, Herr Doctor?
Will you stop it, do you hear? You don't exist.
Oh, really? Then why are you speaking to me?
I wasn't. Robert, now please, listen to me.
Yes, listen to him, Robert. He's confused, you see. His tiny little medical mind can't accept that my words are coming out of your mouth, that I exist in you. Well, why don't we give him some proof, Robert?
No. No.
Do it, Robert.
You hit me.
Who hit you, Herr Doctor? He, Robert, or I, Douglas? Or both? Not sure. Well, why don't we try it once more?
No, Robert, for God's sake. I order you to listen to me.
He orders us, Robert. Well, I think it's time for lesson number two. Let's call it one and one equals two.
Robert.
A simple exercise in physics. So simple that even you will understand, Herr Doctor.
Robert, don't let him take...
One plus one. My will plus Robert's will gives his right hand the strength of two.
Oh, get your hand away from my throat. Will you let... Let go! No! No!
Together now, Robert. Later. There. Good work, Robert.
What happened? What have I done?
Oh, we have removed an obstacle. Let's get rid of it completely.
What?
Get rid of the body. Come on, you better hurry. We've so many other things to do, Robert. You and I.
Yes, Douglas.
Doctor, it's Beth. I'm back. Dr. Brenner, are you...
Beth?
Oh, Bob. You frightened me. What...
Shh. Don't say anything. Come in here. Please hurry.
Bob, what's happening?
We've got to act quickly while he's asleep.
Dr. Brenner?
No. Douglas.
Oh, Bob, please.
Even Douglas has to sleep. Beth, this may be our only chance. Here, I brought this up from the basement.
Oh, my God. Bob, what do you want with an axe?
Beth... You've got to listen. Dr. Brenner is dead.
Oh, dear God.
Well, Douglas made me kill him. He's got control of my right hand. Douglas is taking me over. Beth, we've got to stop him.
Bob, you don't know what you're saying. You're ill.
You've got to help
but
me.
But I don't understand. What do you want me to do?
I want you to take this axe and chop off my right hand. It's the only way.
What? Bob, you're insane.
No, Beth. Beth, this may be the last sane thing I ever do. Now, take the axe, Beth, do it.
I can't.
Of course she can't, Robert.
You bastard!
How could she? A sensitive girl like Beth. No. We have another use for that axe. Pick it up, Robert.
No. Beth! Beth, run, for God's sakes, run!
Pick it up. That's it. Your right hand. Our right hand. Now, Robert.
Bob, what are you doing? Get away from me, Dono. Please, don't.
I can't hold back.
No.
You've destroyed everything I had.
Not everything, Robert. You still have something that rightfully belongs to both of us. I think you've had it long enough.
What? Oh, you can't mean...
Your heart, Robert.
No.
Our heart. The one we shared as babies. The heart you stole from me. I wanted back.
And what would you do with it without me? Where would you put it? Your body turned to dust 30 years ago. Do you think I'm going to let you take over mine? I'd kill myself first, and you with me.
Oh, I suppose you would. So it comes down to a dog in the manger impasse.
What do you mean?
If I can't have our heart, neither can you, brother.
Oh.
So why don't we settle up? Once and for all.
No. No, you can't.
We can, Robert. Let's take our right hand.
Oh, no.
Direct it toward your chest.
No.
Like so.
No, please don't, Douglas. Don't. No.
Like steel claw.
No, God. No.
Just think about it. The look on their faces when they see this and wonder how a man could possibly rip out his own heart.
Have just heard The Repossession by Arthur Samuels. Our script editors are John Douglas and Earl Toppings. Nightfall is produced and directed for CBC Radio by Bill Howell.
Some of my friends insist that I have a warped sense of humor. Hey, that may be true. I often find myself laughing when others are chilled by some book or movie. I don't think I'm weird. I just sit back and enjoy the crap, the flow of the story, the well-turned phrase, the well-conceived scene. In my own defense, I remember once hearing Stephen King say that when he writes, he doesn't scare himself. Sometimes he says he laughs. Sometimes when he writes a particularly scary scene, he laughs, thinking, that'll get him. Maybe it's just that I can only suspend disbelief so far. This doesn't keep me from enjoying these stories. Oh, they do sometimes creep me out. They just don't truly scare me. Show is from Dimension X, which aired on August the 9th of 1951, and based on a short story by Ray Bradbury, The Veil. You quite possibly know the story. I mean, it's really quite famous. Yeah, it's the one that revolves around a family in the distant future who haven't made it, taking advantage of new technologies. They live in a futuristic house that does everything for them, from tying their shoes to cooking their meals. It was published originally as The World the Children Made in the December 23, 1950 issue of the Saturday Evening Post. Later, Bradbury published it in the anthology, a quite famous anthology, really, The Illustrated Men, which came out in 1951. The story has been done a lot, just to name a few. X-1 did a show based on the story in 1955. Bradbury himself reworked it as a play and published it in The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit and Other Plays in 1972. The television series, Ray Bradbury Theater, produced and aired it in 1985. And then in 1989, the CBC produced another televised version of it. That's just in North America. I mean, I know for a fact that it's been done in Australia. It was done in South Africa for SF-68. As a story, it has also sustained considerable literary comment, which I really won't go into now. John A. Rothermich comments that the story is almost devoid of characterization. This is not only true, but it is key to the theme of the story. It may seem strange at first blush that a science fiction story would have a theme wherein technology robs us of our humanity, but it really isn't that odd at all. Science fiction is often decidedly anti-technological.
Adventures in time and space, told in future tense. Dimension The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street and Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction, bring you Dimension X. The soundproofed Happy Life home had cost $30,000 installed. It clothed and fed and rocked them to sleep and played and sang and was good to them. Their life purred on from day to day, measured and controlled by the nucleonic thermostats, the iridium sponge servo brains that made the beds and washed down the bathroom floors and made sure the salt cellars flowed freely without clogging. Twice a day, the house paused, rang a quiet bell, and turned precisely 90 degrees on its axis in order that the view from the Solaroid living room windows might be varied to avoid ennui. Of course, the pride of the house was the nursery. The agent for the company had been most enthusiastic.
This way, right down the hall.
All right.
What was that?
Oh, it's all automatic. The nursery turns itself on when you come within 10 feet of it. Soft automaticity. That's the motto of the company. All right, now, this is the nursery. 40 feet by 40 feet and 30 feet high. Separate power unit with automatic overload circuit breakers. Inspected and approved by the Underwriters Laboratory. The nursery is educational, instructive, entertaining, and therapeutic. The entire control mechanism is adjusted to the electroencephalographic key of the child.
How much does it cost?
30,000 FOB, Los Angeles.
But that's as much as the whole house.
Why, no. But we do want the best for our children, don't we?
Oh, yes, we want the best for our children.
And it was the best. The crystalline walls wavered from 2 to 3 dimensions. The pseudo-textured composition flooring shifted lightly from brick to dirt to waving grass. And the odor of phonics wafted the scent of fantasy through the hermetically conditioned and filtered air. The nursery was the very best. But then they wanted the very best for the children. The technicians installed the nursery, and the heavy coaxial power cable was run in from the main line. The walls sprang to life, and the mental control banks and relays hummed.
All right, Peter and Wendy, this is your nursery.
What's so special about a nursery, Dad?
Plenty. You just go in and see.
Oh, do we have to? It's so big. You promised you'd play ball with me outside, Pop.
Go on, kids. Try out the nursery. It's better than any old yard.
Oh.
Go on in, dear. You'll be surprised.
Gee.
Go ahead, Wendy.
I'm scared. Oh, I'm not. Hey, it's nice in here.
It is?
Come on in, Wendy. Boy, look at the pictures on those walls. They're real.
Well, almost real.
You can change them any way you like just by thinking about it.
Go on in, dear.
Well, all right, Mommy. Hey, Wendy, look what I can do with a picture.
Well, dear, there we are.
They like it, don't they?
Well, why shouldn't they? All they have to do is think, and they've got whatever they want in 3 dimensions. Color, sound, and smell. Oh, think what it would have been like to have a nursery like that when you were a kid.
Mm. It's nice that we can give them all the advantages.
Why, sure. What else are we working for, huh?
Right.
Well, what do you want to do this evening?
Well, the Petersons asked us over for bridge, but...
Oh, we don't have to worry about the kids. They'll be all right in the nursery. Come on, Lydia. We deserve a night out.
And in the nursery, the walls were a kaleidoscope of time and space and imagination. The green forest of Sherwood and quiet forms of Robin and his merry men gave way to the roll of the high seas and the smell of salt in the air as Sir Henry Morgan sailed into the harbor at Jamaica.
It's my turn now, Peter. You've got to be fair. It's my turn.
Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz followed the yellow brick road round the nursery walls. Then Hansel and Gretel discovered the gingerbread house about 3 feet from the door. And from a high tower that stretched into the clouds... The little lame prince sailed out over his kingdom. And behind the crystalline quartz walls, the vacuum tubes and grids and banks of mental image tape spun quietly and efficiently, erasing the line between illusion and reality. Of course, the electric bill from Consolidated Utilities was tremendous, but it was worth it. The house went on. The stove hummed happily in the kitchen, making breakfast, dinner, and supper for four, turning the eggs over lightly and producing popovers electronically calculated by capacity to a 30-volt current and specific gravity. The automatic laundry did the shirts with a medium starch in the collars, except the button-down Oxfords, which had no starch at all. The Happy Life home breathed contentedly as life proceeded with soft automaticity as guaranteed in the brochure and bill of sale.
George.
Hmm?
George, I wish you'd look at the nursery.
Well, what's wrong with this?
Well, I don't know.
Well, that might...
I want you to look at it, that's all. Or call a psychologist to look at it.
What would a psychologist want with a nursery?
Oh, now, George, you know very well what he'd want.
I was in the nursery last week. It's perfectly all right.
Well, it's different now.
Huh? What do you mean, different?
Well, I just want you to come and see.
Are the kids there?
No, Madge Allen took them to a show along with her kids. That's why I want you to look in now before they get back.
All right. What you expect me to do, I don't know. I'm no mechanic.
This isn't a question of a leaky faucet, George.
All right, dear. I'm coming.
The nursery light flicked on as they came down the hall. The relays clicked, and the tubes warmed, and chemical odor banks and pipes bubbled into life as they paused before the closed door.
Go ahead, George. Open it.
On all sides, in three dimensions, stretched the hot, tired landscape of an African veldt, reproduced to the last stick and pebble and bit of straw. The ceiling above them became a sky with a hot, yellow sun. A wind blew in from the baked veldtland, the hot straw smell of lion grass, the cool, green smell of the hidden waterhole, the great, rusty smell of animals, the smell of dust like red paprika on the hot air. And now the sounds. The howl of the jackal in the distance, the thump of distant antelope feet on grassy sod, and the papery rustling of the great vultures that wheeled and circled under the yellow, burning sun.
Oh, let's get out of this sun. It's a little too real.
Oh, no, George, you promised you'd look around.
Well, I don't see
anything. Now, wait a minute. Look, there are the vultures.
Filthy creatures.
And there are the lions. Far over that way.
Yes, I see them.
They're on their way to the water hole. They've just eaten.
Eaten?
Yes, I can't see what.
Sun's too strong.
Well, shade your eyes.
Some animal. A zebra or a baby giraffe, maybe.
Can you see it? Are you sure?
It's a little too late to be sure. Nothing over there but clean bone. Vultures dropping for what's left.
George.
Hmm?
Did you hear that scream?
What scream?
Just now.
I'm sorry, hon, no.
Here come the lions. George, they're frightening.
Take it easy, Lydia. They're just illusions.
It was a miracle of mechanical efficiency. The lions prowling toward them over the tawny veldtland. A miracle of inventive genius. Every house should have one. The lions were 15 feet away. So real, so startlingly real, you could feel the prickling fur on your hand. Your mouth was stuffed with the dusty upholstery smell of their heated pelts. The yellow of them was in your eyes, like the yellow of an exquisite tapestry. The yellows of lions and summer grass. The sound of the matted lion lungs exhaling on the silent noontide. And the smell of meat from the panting, dripping mouths.
George, I'm afraid. They're so real.
They're only an illusion, Lydia, that's all.
Watch out!
Oh, quick, outside!
Oh, George, George.
Lydia, Lydia, my poor, sweet Lydia.
George, they almost got us.
No, 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 no. Take it easy. Calm down.
Yes, but I could feel their breath.
No, no, no. Get a hold of yourself, Lydia. They aren't real. Walls, that's all it is. Crystalloid walls.
But they look so real.
Yes, yes, darling. Of course they do. But it's all dimensional color reactionary process and mental tape film behind glass screens. It's all odorophonics and sonics. Now, here. Here, take my handkerchief.
I'm afraid, George. Did you see? Did you feel? It's too real.
No, no, Lydia.
We've got to tell Wendy and Peter not to read any more on Africa.
Yes, yes, of course, dear.
Do you promise?
Sure, sure.
And lock the nursery for a few days.
Oh, now, wait a minute, dear. Let's keep our sense of proportion.
George, I want you to lock that place up.
Honey, you know how difficult Peter is about that. I punished him last week by locking the nursery for an afternoon, and he threw a tantrum, and Wendy, too. Honey, they live for the nursery.
I tell you, it's got to be locked. That's all there is to it.
Lydia, you need a rest.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I don't have enough to do. I have too much time to think. All I do is set the menu selector dials at the beginning of the week.
But, honey, that's the whole idea. The house is automatic.
I know. But couldn't we turn it off for a couple of weeks? Just a couple of weeks and take a vacation.
You mean that you want to fry eggs for me?
Yes, I do. And darn socks, too. I feel like I don't belong here. The house is wife and mother and maid. How can I compete with the African veldt? And you, George, You don't know what to do with yourself in the house when you're home. You're drinking too much.
Am I?
You feel useless, too.
Yes, I I suppose I do.
George.
Hmm?
Those lions can't get out of there, can they?
Oh, of course not, dear. Now, don't think about it anymore.
They ate alone. He sat idly watching the dining room table produce warm dishes of food from its mechanical interior.
You forgot the ketchup. That's better.
It wouldn't hurt to lock the children out of the nursery for a while. It was clear that they'd been spending too much time in Africa. Oh, that sun. He could still feel it on his neck like a hot paw. And the lions. And the smell of blood. Remarkable how the nursery caught the telepathic emanations of the children's minds and created a life to fulfill their desires. The children thought zebras, and there were zebras. Sun, sun. Death, and death. They were so young. But long before you knew what death was, you were wishing it on someone else. But this, the long, hot African veldt, the awful death in the jaws of a lion, and repeated again and again and again. The children came home dutifully at 8:30.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Pop.
Hi, Peter. You want something to eat, Wendy?
No, thanks.
Well, we're just having dessert.
We're full of strawberry ice cream.
And hot dogs.
We'll just sit and watch.
Sure. Peter, tell us about the nursery.
Nursery?
Yes, all about Africa and everything,
I don't understand.
Your mother and I were just traveling through Africa with rod and reel.
There's no Africa in the nursery.
Oh, come now, Peter. We know better.
I don't remember any Africa. Do you, Wen? Run and see, huh? Sure. I'll be right back.
Wendy, come back here. Wendy.
She'll be right back,
Pop. She doesn't have to. I've seen it. Now, come on.
Sure, Pop. Wendy will tell us, though.
Could they be lying?
We'll see in just a moment. Peter, open the door.
See, Daddy? It's not Africa. It's Florida. Like in the yearlings.
There go the deer, see? It isn't Africa.
Yes, I see it isn't. Go to bed.
But it is 9 o'clock.
No, it isn't.
You heard me. Go to bed.
Okay. Night, Mom. Night, Pop.
Good night. Good night, dears. I'll be right in.
Lydia, wait a minute. Here, look. Look at this.
What is it?
This is the corner where the lions were, isn't it?
What's that you picked up?
It's an old wallet of mine. There's a smell of hot grass on it. The smell of a lion. It's wet with saliva. And it's been chewed.
George, those smears are blood.
Come on out. Now let's go to bed.
Went to bed. But in the middle of the night, Lydia was still awake, and she knew her husband was awake.
George? How did your wallet get in the nursery?
I don't know. Wendy must have changed the walls from the African veldt. Honey, I'm going to keep it locked. Maybe it isn't good for the children.
It's supposed to help them work off their neuroses in a harmless way.
I'm starting to wonder.
We've given the children everything they wanted.
My father used to say children are like carpets. They should be stepped on occasionally. We've never lifted a hand. They're spoiled.
And we're spoiled.
I think I'll have Dr. McLean come tomorrow morning and have a look at Africa.
Yes, only it isn't Africa now. It's Florida and the yearling.
I have a feeling it'll be Africa again before then.
George! Wendy and Peter are in their room.
No. They've broken into the nursery.
Those screams. They sounded familiar.
Did they?
Yes, awfully. Oh, George.
somno beds tried very hard. The two adults couldn't be rocked to sleep for another hour. A smell of cats was in the night air. And in the morning, the stove cooked French toast, and the dining room table poured the syrup and melted butter.
Pop!
Yes?
You aren't going to lock up the nursery for good, are you?
That all depends.
On what?
On you and your sister.
We feel that you should have some variety, dear.
If you interspersed this Africa with a little Sweden or China...
I thought we were free to play the way we like.
Well, you are within reasonable bounds.
Well, what's wrong with Africa, Daddy?
Oh, so now you admit you've been thinking of Africa, hmm?
I wouldn't want the nursery locked up ever.
Well, as a matter of fact, we're thinking of turning the whole house off for about a month. Sort of camping out.
You mean I'd have to tie my own shoes instead of having my shoe tire do it? And brush my own teeth and comb my own hair and give myself a bath?
Well, Wendy, it would be fun for a change, don't you think, dear?
No, it'd be awful. I didn't like it when you took out the picture painter last month.
Well, that's because I wanted you to learn to paint by yourself.
I don't want to do anything but look and listen and smell. What else is there to do?
Oh, all right. All right, go play in Africa.
Are you going to shut off the house?
We're considering it.
I don't think you'd better consider it anymore, Pop.
I won't have any threats from you, son.
Okay, Pop. Come on, Wendy. Let's get back.
After breakfast, Dr. David McLean was announced by the audio knocker. And the dining room table, recognizing him as an old friend, poured an extra cup of coffee, light with four lumps.
I saw the nursery last year, George. It looked all right to me. You didn't notice anything unusual?
No. Well, the pattern showed the usual violence, a tendency towards slight paranoia. All children feel persecuted by their parents. Perfectly normal.
I locked the nursery and they broke into it last night. I let them stay so they could form the patterns for you to see. Here it is.
Well, suppose we take a look at it right now.
They entered without knocking and sent the children out. The screams had faded, and the lions were feeding quietly under the trees.
Wish I could see what they're eating. Do you suppose some high-powered binoculars would...
Hardly, no.
How long has this been going on?
A little over a month.
It certainly doesn't feel good.
I don't want feelings. I want fact,
George. George, a psychologist, never saw a fact in his life. He knows about feelings, and this doesn't feel good. My advice to you is to have the whole room torn down and your children brought to me every day for the next year for treatment.
Is it that bad?
I'm afraid so. You know, that's why the nursery was developed originally, to let us examine the patterns left on the wall by a child's mind.
But what is it? What's wrong with Peter and Wendy?
Well... It's hard to say.
I haven't punished them more than average, though I took away a few gadgets. Last week, I locked the nursery to show I meant business.
George, you've let this room replace you and your wife and your children's affections. This room is their real father and mother. And now you come along and want to shut it. You can feel the hatred coming out of that sky. George, turn everything off. The nursery, the automatic kitchen, the whole confounded automatic house. Start now.
But won't the shock be too much for the children?
I don't want them going any deeper. Let's get out of here. I never liked these rooms. Get me nerves.
Those lions look real, don't they? I don't suppose there's any way that...
What?
That they could become real.
Certainly not.
Some flaw in the machinery, tampering.
No.
I don't imagine the room will like being turned on.
Nothing ever likes to die. Even a room.
I wonder if it hates me for turning it on.
Paranoia is thick today.
Hello.
Is this your scarf?
It's stained.
Brown.
Say, that's blood.
That's Lydia's. Come on, the main fuse box is out here. Go ahead. Pull the switch.
Yeah. It's off.
The two children were in hysterics. They screamed and kicked and threw things. They yelled and sobbed and swore and jumped on the furniture, weeping.
It's off and it stays off. The whole house dies as of now. The more I see of the mess we put ourselves in, the more it sickens me. We've been contemplating our electrical, mechanical navels for too long. We need air. Fresh, unfiltered, unconditioned air.
He marched around the house, cutting switches and pulling fuses. The stove was disconnected with a roast lamb in the oven and a flapjack still in the air. The heater, the shoe shiners, the shoelacers, the body scrubbers and swabbers and massagers. He pulled the plugs and shorted out the controls, one after the other. The house became full of electronic corpses. It was a mechanical cemetery. So silent. None of the humming, hidden energy of the machines waiting to function at the tap of a button. And by the still dining room table, its radionic insides dead and currentless, Peter wailed at the house.
Don't let them do it! Don't let Pop kill everything! I hate you, Pop! I hate you!
Peter, please!
Insults won't get you anywhere.
I wish you were dead!
We were for a long while. Now we're going to start really living.
One more, Daddy, just one more!
Oh, Wendy, honey.
One minute in the nursery, that's all. Just one more minute.
Oh, George, it can't hurt, really.
Oh, all right, only shut up. 1 minute, and that's the end. Forever.
Gee, thanks, Pop, thanks.
Then we're going on a vacation. Dr. McLean is coming in a half hour to help us out. Lydia, turn on the nursery.
Now remember, kids, it'll be just for 1 minute.
Oh, boy. Come on, Wendy. Come on.
Oh, thanks, Daddy. Thanks a lot.
Just 1 minute, remember. Oh, where'd I put those suitcases? Lydia.
Don't shout, George. I'm right here.
Oh, did you leave them alone in the nursery?
Well, I've got to get ready, George. Oh, that awful Africa. What can they see in it?
Well, in an hour, we'll be on our way to Iowa. What prompted us to buy a nightmare like that?
Pride, I guess. We had the money and we were foolish.
I guess we'd better get them out of there before they get involved with those beasts again.
Pop! Pop! Come in! Daddy! Mommy!
Come on, quick.
Wendy! Wendy, Peter, what's the matter?
Hurry up. Open the nursery. Wendy! Peter!
Well, they aren't anywhere. Wendy! Peter!
Peter! The door. Open the door. They've locked it from the outside. Peter! Peter, open up! Peter!
Don't let them! Turn off the nursery!
Now, don't get ridiculous, children. It's time to go.
Wendy! Wendy, open the door, dear!
Let us out! Peter, open the door! Time to go! Open the door!
George! George, the lion!
Peter, do you hear me? Open this door!
They're all around us! George!
Son! Son, do you hear me? Let us out!
George, look out! The lions are coming!
When Dr. David McLean came a half hour later, he found the two children in the nursery sitting in the center of the open glade, eating a picnic lunch. Beyond them was the water hole in the yellow veldt land. Above was the hot sun. Dr. McLean saw at a distance the lions fighting and clawing, and then settling down to feed in silence under the shady trees.
Hi, kids. Where are your mom and dad?
They'll be here directly.
Good. Good. We've got to get going.
He squinted at the lions with his hands up to his eyes. Now they were done feeding. They moved to the water hole to drink. A shadow flickered as the vultures dropped down from the blazing sky. To finish, what the lions had left.
Dr. McLean. Dr. McLean?
Huh? What?
Have a cup of tea.
We have The Big Bounce. Now, you might be thinking of the Elmo Leonard novel of the same name, but no, it's not that at all. And if you're of a cosmological bent, you might be thinking of The Big Bounce in terms of cosmology, where it refers to a cyclical or oscillatory model of the universe. Actually, it's a short story by Walter Tevis. It's about a small rubber-like substance that each time it bounces a little bit higher. Sounds suspiciously like flubber of the absent-minded professor. And the story was written before the movie came out. The story was published in Galaxy magazine for February of 1958, which was well before the movie The Absent-Minded Professor came out with its flubber. It's a little suspicious, isn't it? But I don't think we need to be too quick to accuse anybody of plagiarism. You know, sometimes these ideas are just sort of in the air.
Bounce. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Jerome Lawson. December 2007. The Big Bounce by Walter S. Tevis. Seeing it in action, anybody would quaver in alarm. What hath Farnsworth overwrought?
Let me show you something,
Farnsworth said. He set his near-empty drink, a Bacardi martini, on the mantel, and waddled out of the room toward the basement. I sat in my big leather chair, feeling very peaceful with the world, watching the fire. Whatever Farnsworth would have to show tonight would be far more entertaining than watching TV, my custom on other evenings. Farnsworth, with his four labs in the house and his very tricky mind, never failed to provide my best night of the week. When he returned, after a moment, he had with him a small box, about 3 inches square. He held this carefully in one hand and stood by the fireplace dramatically, or as dramatically as a very small, very fat man with pink cheeks can stand by a fireplace of the sort that seems to demand a big man with tweeds, pipe, and perhaps a saber wound. Anyway, he held the box dramatically and he said,
"Last week I was playing around in the chem lab, trying to make a new kind of rubber eraser. Did quite well with the other drafting equipment, you know, especially the dimensional curve and the photosensitive ink. Well, I approached the job by trying for a material that would absorb graphite without abrading paper."
I was a little disappointed with this. It sounded pretty tame, but I said, "How did it come out?" He screwed his pudgy face up thoughtfully.
"Synthesized the material, all right, and it seems to work. But the interesting thing is that it has a certain, secondary property that would make it quite awkward to use. Interesting property, though. Unique, I'm inclined to believe."
This began to sound more like it. "And what property is that?" I poured myself a shot of straight rum from the bottle sitting on the table beside me. I did not like straight rum, but I preferred it to Farnsworth's rather imaginative cocktails.
"I'll show you, John," he said.
He opened the box, and I could see that it was packed with some kind of batting. He fished in this and withdrew a gray ball about the size of a golf ball and set the box on the mantel. "And that's the eraser?" I asked.
"Yes,"
he said. Then he squatted down, held the ball about a half inch from the floor, dropped it. It bounced, naturally enough. Then it bounced again, and again. Only this was not natural, for on the second bounce the ball went higher in the air than on the first, and on the third bounce higher still. After a half minute my eyes were bugging out, and the little ball was bouncing 4 feet in the air, and going higher each time. I grabbed my glass. "What in the world?" I said. Farnsworth caught the ball in a pudgy hand and held it. He was smiling a little sheepishly.
"Interesting effect, isn't it?"
"Now wait a minute," I said, beginning to think about it. "What's the gimmick? What kind of motor do you have in that thing?" His eyes were wide and a little hurt.
"No gimmick, John. None at all. Just a very peculiar molecular structure."
"Structure?" I said. "Bouncing balls just don't pick up energy out of nowhere. I don't care how the molecules are put together. And you don't get energy out without putting energy in."
"Oh," he said. "That's the really interesting thing. Of course you're right. Energy does go into the ball. Here, I'll show you."
He let the ball drop again and it began bouncing.
higher and higher, until it was hitting the ceiling. Farnsworth reached out to catch it, but he fumbled, and the thing glanced off his hand, hit the mantelpiece, and zipped across the room. It banged into the far wall, ricocheted, banked off three other walls, picking up speed all the time. When it whizzed by me like a rifle bullet, I began to get worried, but it hit against one of the heavy draperies by the window, and this damped its motion enough so that it fell to the floor. It started bouncing again immediately, but Farnsworth stumbled across the room and grabbed it. He was perspiring a little, and he began instantly to transfer the ball from one hand to another and back again, as if it were hot.
"Here," he said, and handed it to me.
I almost dropped it.
"That's like a ball of ice," I said.
"Have you been keeping it in the refrigerator?"
"No. As a matter of fact, it was at room temperature a few minutes ago."
"Now wait a minute," I said. "I only teach physics in high school, but I know better than that. Moving around in warm air doesn't make anything cold except by evaporation."
"Well, there's your input and output, John,"
he said.
"The ball lost heat and took on motion. Simple conversion."
My jaw must have dropped to my waist. "Do you mean that little thing is converting heat to kinetic energy?"
"Apparently."
"But that's impossible." He was beginning to smile thoughtfully. The ball was not as cold now as it had been, and I was holding it in my lap.
"A steam engine does it," he said, "and a steam turbine. Of course, they're not very efficient."
"They work mechanically, too, and only because water expands when it turns into steam."
"This seems to do it differently,"
he said, sipping thoughtfully at his dark brown martini.
"I don't know exactly how. Maybe something piezoelectric about the way its molecules slide about. I ran some tests, measured its impact energy in foot-pounds, and compared that with the heat loss in BTUs. It seemed to be about 98% efficient, as close as I could tell. Apparently it converts heat into bounce very well. Interesting, isn't it?"
"Interesting?" I almost came flying out of my chair. My mind was beginning to spin like crazy. "If you're not filling my leg with this thing, Farnsworth, you've got something by the tail there that's just a little bit bigger than the discovery of fire." He blushed modestly.
"I'd rather thought that myself,"
he admitted. "Good grief, look at the heat that's available," I said, getting really excited now. Farnsworth was still smiling, very pleased with himself.
"I suppose you could put this thing in a box with convection fins and let it bounce around inside."
"I'm way ahead of you," I said, "but that wouldn't work. All your kinetic energy would go right back to heat on impact, and eventually that little ball would build up enough speed to blast its way through any box you could build."
"Then how would you work it?"
"Well," I said, choking down the rest of my rum, "you'd seal the ball in a big steel cylinder, attach the cylinder to a crankshaft and flywheel, give the thing a shake to start the ball bouncing back and forth, and let it run like a gasoline engine or something. It would get all the heat it needed from the air in a normal room. Mount the apparatus in your house and it would pump your water, operate a generator, and keep you cool at the same time." I sat down again, shakily, and began pouring myself another drink. Farnsworth had taken the ball from me and was carefully putting it back in its padded box. He was visibly showing excitement, too. I could see that his cheeks were ruddier and his eyes even brighter than normal.
"But what if you want the cooling and don't have any work to be done?"
"Simple," I said. "You just let the machine turn a flywheel, or lift weights and drop them, or something like that outside your house. You have an air intake inside, and if in the winter you don't want to lose heat, you just mount the thing in an outside building, attach it to your generator, and use the power to do whatever you want. Heat your house, say. There's plenty of heat in the outside air, even in December."
"John," said Farnsworth, "you're very ingenious. It might work."
"Of course it'll work." Pictures were beginning to light up in my head. "And don't you realize that this is the answer to the solar power problem? Why, mirrors and selenium are, at best, 10% efficient. Think of big pumping stations on the Sahara. All that heat, all that need for power, for irrigation." I paused a moment for effect. "Farnsworth, this can change the very shape of the Earth." Farnsworth seemed to be lost in thought. Finally, he looked at me strangely and said,
"Perhaps we'd better try to build a model."
I was so excited by the thing that I couldn't sleep that night. I kept dreaming of power stations, ocean liners, even automobiles, being operated by balls bouncing back and forth in cylinders. I even worked out a spaceship in my mind, a bullet-shaped affair with a huge rubber ball on its end, gyroscopes to keep it oriented properly, the ball serving as solution to that biggest of missile engineering problems, excess heat. You'd build a huge concrete launching field, support it all the way down to bedrock, hop in the ship and start bouncing. Of course, it would be kind of a rough ride. In the morning, I called my superintendent and told him to get a substitute for the rest of the week. I was going to be busy. Then I started working in the machine shop in Farnsworth's basement, trying to turn out a working model of a device that, by means of a crankshaft, oleo dampers, and a reciprocating cylinder, would pick up some of the random kinetic energy from the bouncing ball and do something useful with it, like turning a driveshaft. I was just working out a convection and air pump system for circulating hot air around the ball when Farnsworth came in. He had tucked carefully under his arm a sphere of about the size of a basketball, and, if he had made it to my specifications, weighing 35 pounds. He had a worried frown on his forehead.
"It looks good,"
I said. "What's the trouble?"
"There seems to be a slight hitch,"
he said.
"I've been testing for conductivity. It seems to be quite low."
"That's what I'm working on now. It's just a mechanical problem of pumping enough warm air back to the ball. We can do it with no more than 20% efficiency loss. In an engine, that's nothing.
Maybe you're right, but this material conducts heat even less than rubber does.
The little ball yesterday didn't seem to have any trouble, I said.
Naturally not. It had plenty of time to warm up before I started it, and its mass-surface-area relationship was pretty low. The larger you make a sphere, of course, the more mass inside in proportion to the outside area.
You're right, but I think we can whip it. We may have to honeycomb the ball and have part of the work the machine does operate a big air pump, but we can work it out. All that day I worked with lathe, milling machine, and hacksaw. After clamping the new big ball securely to a workbench, Farnsworth pitched in to help me. But we weren't able to finish by nightfall, and Farnsworth turned his spare bedroom over to me for the night. I was too tired to go home. And too tired to sleep soundly, too. Farnsworth lived on the edge of San Francisco, by a big truck bypass, and almost all night I wrestled with the pillow and sheets, listening half-consciously to those heavy trucks rumbling by, and in my mind, always, that little gray ball, bouncing and bouncing and bouncing. At daybreak, I came abruptly fully awake with the sound of crashing echoing in my ears, a battering sound that seemed to come from the basement. I grabbed my coat and pants, rushed out of the room, almost knocked over Farnsworth, who was struggling to get his shoes on out in the hall, and we scrambled down the two flights of stairs together. The place was a chaos, battered and bashed equipment everywhere, and on the floor, overturned against the far wall, the table that the ball had been clamped to. The ball itself was gone. I had not been fully asleep all night, and the sight of that mess and what it meant jolted me immediately awake. Something, probably a heavy truck, had started a tiny oscillation in that ball. And the ball had been heavy enough to start the table bouncing with it until, by dancing that table around the room, it had literally torn the clamp off and shaken itself free. What had happened afterwards was obvious, with the ball building up velocity with every successive bounce. But where was the ball now? Suddenly Farnsworth cried out hoarsely, "Look!" And I followed his outstretched, pudgy finger to where, at one side of the basement, a window had been broken open. A small window, but plenty big enough for something the size of a basketball to crash through. There was a little weak light coming from outdoors, and then I saw the ball. It was in Farnsworth's backyard, bouncing a little sluggishly on the grass. The grass would damp it, hold it back, until we could get to it, unless. I took off up the basement steps like a streak. Just beyond the backyard, I had caught a glimpse of something that frightened me. A few yards from where I had seen the ball was the edge of the big six-lane highway, a broad ribbon of smooth, hard concrete. I got through the house to the back porch, rushed out, and was in the backyard just in time to see the ball take its first bounce onto the concrete. I watched it, fascinated, when it hit. After the soft, energy-absorbing turf, the concrete was like a springboard. Immediately, the ball flew high in the air. I was running across the yard toward it, praying under my breath, "Fall on that grass next time." It hit before I got to it, and right on the concrete again, and this time I saw it go straight up at least 50 feet. My mind was suddenly full of thoughts of dragging mattresses from the house, or making a net or something to stop that hurtling 35 pounds, but I stood where I was, unable to move, and saw it come down again on the highway. It went up 100 feet, and down again on the concrete about 15 feet further down the road, in the direction of the city. That time it was 200 feet, and when it hit again it made a thud that you could have heard for a quarter of a mile. I could practically see it flatten out on the road before it took off upward again, at twice the speed it had hit at. Suddenly generating an idea, I whirled and ran back to Farnsworth's house. He was standing in the yard now, shivering from the morning air, looking at me like a little lost and badly scared child. "Where are your car keys?" I almost shouted at him.
"In my pocket."
"Come on." I took him by the arm and half dragged him to the carport. I got the keys from him, started the car, and by mangling about 7 traffic laws and 3 prize rose bushes, managed to get on the highway, facing in the direction that the ball was heading. "Look," I said, trying to drive down the road and search for the ball at the same time. "It's risky, but if we can get the car under it and we can hop out in time, it should crash through the roof. That ought to slow it down enough for us to nab it."
"But what about my car?"
Farnsworth bleated. "What about the first building, or first person, it hits in San Francisco?"
"Oh," he said. "Hadn't thought of that."
I slowed the car and stuck my head out the window. It was lighter now, but no sign of the ball. If it happens to get to town, any town for that matter, it'll be falling from about 10 or 20 miles, or 40.
"Maybe it'll go high enough first so that it'll burn, like a meteor."
"No chance," I said. "Built-in cooling system, remember?" Farnsworth formed his mouth into an O, and exactly at that moment there was a resounding thump, and I saw the ball hit in a field, maybe 20 yards from the edge of the road, and take off again. This time it didn't seem to double its velocity, and I figured the ground was soft enough to hold it back, but it wasn't slowing down either, not with a bounce factor of better than 2 to 1. Without watching for it to go up, I drove as quickly as I could off the road and over, carrying part of a wire fence with me, to where it had hit. There was no mistaking it. There was a depression about 3 feet deep, like a small crater. I jumped out of the car and stared up. It took me a few seconds to spot it, over my head. Once I had caught by the pale and slanting morning sunlight, it was only a bright diminishing speck. The car motor was running, and I waited until the ball disappeared for a moment and then reappeared. I watched for another couple of seconds until I felt I could make a decent guess on its direction, hollered at Farnsworth to get out of the car. It had just occurred to me that there was no use risking his life, too. Dove in and drove 100 yards or so to the spot I had anticipated. I stuck my head out the window and up. The ball was the size of an egg now. I adjusted the car's position, jumped out, and ran for my life. It hit instantly after, about 60 feet away from the car. And at the same time, it occurred to me that what I was trying to do was completely impossible. Better to hope that the ball hit a pond, or bounced out to sea, or landed in a sand dune. All we could do would be to follow, and if it ever was damped down enough, grab it. It had hit soft ground and didn't double its height that time, but it had still gone higher. It was out of sight for almost a lifelong minute, and then, incredibly rotten luck, it came down, with an ear-shattering thwack, on the concrete highway again. I had seen it hit, and instantly afterward I saw a crack as wide as a finger open along the entire width of the road, and the ball had flown back up like a rocket. My word, I was thinking, now it means business. And on that next bounce, it seemed like an incredibly long time that we craned our necks, Farnsworth and I, watching for it to reappear in the sky. And when it finally did, we could hardly follow it. It whistled like a bomb, and we saw the gray streak come plummeting to earth almost a quarter of a mile from where we were standing. But we didn't see it go back up again. For a moment, we stared at each other silently. Then Farnsworth almost whispered,
"Perhaps it's landed in a pond."
"Or in the world's biggest cow pile," I said. "Come on." We could have met our deaths by rock salt and buckshot that night, if the farmer who owned that field had been home. We tore up everything we came to getting across it, including cabbages and rhubarb, but we had to search for 10 minutes, and even then we didn't find the ball. What we found was a hole in the ground that could have been a small-scale meteor crater. It was a good 20 feet deep, but at the bottom, no ball. I stared widely at it for a full minute before I focused my eyes enough to see, at the bottom, 1,000 little gray fragments. And immediately it came to both of us at the same time. A poor conductor. The ball had used up all its available heat on that final impact. Like a golf ball that has been dipped in liquid air and dropped, it had smashed into thin splinters. The hole had sloping sides, and I scrambled down in it and picked up one of the pieces, using my handkerchief, folded. There was no telling just how cold it would be. It was the stuff all right, and colder than an icicle. I climbed out. "Let's go home," I said. Farnsworth looked at me thoughtfully. Then he sort of cocked his head to one side and asked,
"What do you suppose will happen when those pieces thaw?"
I stared at him. I began to think of 1,000 tiny slivers whizzing around erratically, ricocheting off buildings in downtown San Francisco, and in 20 countries, and no matter what they hit, moving and accelerating as long as there was any heat in the air to give them energy. And then I saw a tool shed, on the other side of the pasture from us. But Farnsworth was ahead of me, waddling along, puffing. He got the shovels out and handed one to me. We didn't say a word, neither of us, for hours. It takes a long time to fill a hole 20 feet deep, especially when you're shoveling very, very carefully, and packing down the dirt very, very hard. End of The Big Bounce by Walter S. Tevis. Recording by Jerome Lawson. December 2007.
Living on the road, my friend, gonna make you free and clean. Now you wear your skin like iron, your breath's as hot as kerosene. Weren't your mama's only boy, but her favorite one, it seems. She began to cry when you said goodbye, and you sank into your dreams. Pancho was a bandit bold, his horse as fast as polished steel. Wore his gun outside his clothes for all the honest world to feel. Pancho met his match, you know, on a desert down in Mexico. No one heard his dying words. Oh, but that's the way it goes. And all the federales say we could have had him any day. They only let him slip away out of kindness, I suppose. Lefty, he can't sing the blues all night long like he used to do. The dust that Pancho bit down south ended up in Lefty's mouth. The day they laid poor Pancho low, Lefty split for Ohio.
Where he got the grit to go,
well, there ain't nobody knows.
tell how Poncho fell and left his living in a cheap hotel. The desert's quiet and Cleveland's cold, so the story ends untold.
Poncho needs your prayers, it's true, but save a few for Lefty too. He only did what he had to do. Now he's gone.
And a few gray federales say we could have had him any day. They only let him slip away out of kindness, I suppose. Said a few gray federales say we could have had him any day. They only let him go so wrong out of kindness, I suppose.
On a Friday it fell in the month of Avril, o'er the hill came the moon with a blithe sunny smile, and the folks were thronging the roads everywhere, making haste to be in at Coffey Hall Fair. I've seen them coming in from the mountains and glen, both rosy-faced lasses and strapping young men, with the joy in their heart and unburdened to care, would meet and know friends and capture home affair. There's lads for the lasses, there's toys for the bands, there's jugglers and tumblers and folks with no arms. There's a ballad singer here and a fiddler there, with a nutman and spiceman that got to home affair. There are peddlers and the potters and gingerbread stands. There are peep shows and puffin darts and the green caravans. There's fruit from all nations exhibited there, with kale plants from the Harwich at Coffshire Home Fair. And now about the hiring, if you want to hear a tell, you shall ken it as far as I've seen it myself. What wages they addle, it's ill to declare, the muckle they vary at Coffshire Home Fair. Just yet I've seen she's a strapping young queen. He asked what her age was and where she had been, what work she'd been doing, how long she'd been there, what wages she wanted and cost her home affair. Just then the bit lass stood a wee while in gloom, and she blushed and she scraped with her feet on the ground. Then she plucked up her heart and it stoutly declared, well, a 5 pound and 10 had got to home affair. Says he, but my lass, that's a very big wage. Then he turning about like he been in a rage, says, I'll give you 5 pounds, but I'll give you name there. And I think you man the ticket I'd got to home affair. He took out a shilling, put a home a bit of wench, in the case it might enter her head for to flinch. But she grabbed at it, muttering, I should have had more, but I think I will attack it and cop to home affair. Now the hirings over and off they all sprang into the ballroom for to join in the throng. And they never will I with my mammy name. The fiddles play briskly at Coffshire Home Fair. Now this is the fashion, they thus pass the day, till the night coming on they all hally away. And some are so sick that they'll never jump more, with the fighting and dancing at Coffshire Home Fair.